Thank you very much for your attention so far. Okay, my name is Andy Domatsky. I'm at the University of Leeds. This work is done in collaboration with people in Bristol. And actually, one of the main authors that did a lot of the measurements here is Asher, who is now an accountant, but was an undergraduate project student at the time that this work was done. So thank you for inviting me along, Barbara, and for organising what's been a really great meeting so far. In some ways, I also feel like a bit of a fraud. I'm a part-timer when it comes to looking at intermediate and deep seismicity and earthquakes. But the story I'm going to tell you today, I hope, will be of interest to you. So before I go on, I'm just going to plug a meeting that we're hosting in London in May. It's a Royal Astronomical Society specialist discussion meeting, which means it's free and open for people to attend. And I hope that some of you might like to come along to that in May next year, where we're going to continue the discussion. And this meeting actually happens after a two-day meeting about more general deep earth things. Okay, so shameless plug over there. Let's move on. Okay, so this talk is going to be about anisotropy, seismic anisotropy inside the Earth's transition zone, or where is it exactly, is sort of the question we'll address. And really, for a long time, people had assumed that the Earth's transition zone should be isotropic or shouldn't show any strong seismic anisotropy. And we'll discuss the reasons why that assumption was made shortly. But increasingly, it's become apparent that this isn't a good enough approximation and there is anisotropy in the transition zone. The trick is, though, we don't really have yet a strong handle on exactly where it occurs in the transition zone. It seems likely that the sort of tectonically interesting parts where the slabs are could be responsible, but we're only slowly converging on an answer here. If I point you to this plot on the top right, this is a sort of radial average of this value of the Xi parameter, my least favourite Greek letter to write. And Xi just means the ratio squared of the velocity of this SH wave, the horizontally polarised S wave, to the vertically polarised wave. So it's a squared ratio of those velocities. And this is in an hexagonal symmetry. So we're assuming transverse anisotropy in hexagonal symmetry. And so when this Xi number is bigger than 1, that means that SH is fast. And when it's less than 1, that means that SV is fast. Now, we've got better and better at within this approximation of vertical transverse anisotropy, where the Earth is hexagonally symmetric and it has a vertical symmetry axis. We've got sort of better and better at interpreting our data in terms of that. And now there's a series of tomography models, I think Anna Ferreira would agree, increasing in how good they are as you go to the right. Not sure Barbara would agree necessarily. But there's, as I say, there's at least two experts in this room now who can do a really good job of measuring this and interpreting the seismograms in this way in a global tomographic sense. And so what you do notice, though, is that these models are somewhat different, and there are areas that agree and there are areas that disagree. And so in the study that I'm going to show you, is we're sort of looking in a slightly more precise way, but with a lot less data. So let's, with that in mind, let's then move on to talk about why it was considered that the transition zone in general shouldn't show this strong anisotropy when clearly now we know that it does in some description. Well, really, that was because it wasn't obvious what would cause anisotropy in the transition zone. If we think about the sort of ambient transition zone away from the slabs, where we might expect the composition to be something like pyrolite, the minerals that are present in any great volume in this part of the Earth, well, ringwoodite is essentially isotropic. There's no real way of generating the values of anisotropy that we see with that. Wadsite could be, but it doesn't seem in experiments so far to strongly form texture, although, you know, things change very quickly in the world of deformation experiments. Meanwhile, the majorite phase of garnet is also incredibly anisotropic, as far as minerals go, and calcium perovskite, which is sort of ever the bridesmaid but never the bride of mantle mineral phases, it probably isn't really voluminous enough throughout the transition zone to have a strong contribution to the anisotropy there either. So we're left with this sort of puzzling situation, which is that the largest volume, perhaps, of the transition zone doesn't host minerals which could really form a strong texture and become seismically anisotropic. So, and just to sort of show you how long this sort of puzzle's been going on for, I can show you a plot from Steve Kirby's review paper on olivine metastability. And because really, until now, metastable olivine has been probably one of the best candidates to explain why you could have anisotropy in the transition zone, and therefore it would only occur in slabs, and only in slabs that are cold enough to host metastable olivine for any sort of large volume within the transition zone. So now I'm going to talk, that's sort of the puzzle, and I'm going to show you now some new results that maybe, or maybe don't, place some constraints on what's going on. So we're going to use shear wave splitting. The shear wave splitting is a phenomenon which occurs in the presence of seismic anisotropy, or indeed any anisotropy, where there's shear going on. So just like optic birefringence, a wave that travels through an anisotropic region splits into two waves, a fast wave in blue here and a slow wave in red. The fast wave travels faster, and so on the other side we can measure that there's a delay time between the fast and slow shear waves, and we can also measure the orientation of the fast wave. Now these values here are going to depend on how big your box is, for a start, also how strongly anisotropic that medium is in that particular direction, and that's sort of the extra information that we can get out by using both the orientation and the amount of splitting. So this is sort of the extra info that we're hoping to be able to get here. And really, the key with anisotropy is that some sort of ordering has occurred. You've either aligned crystals or inclusions or something like that, and that tells you that there's some sort of organized process happening, putting energy in to make a material organized. And you can contrast that with the sort of ambient idea of the mantle just in hydrostatic equilibrium with no texture. We shouldn't get it. So it tells you that a process is happening to organize the material. So this is the sort of overview of our method, therefore. And what we're doing is looking at anisotropy in the region of deep earthquakes. And in this study, I'm only going to look at earthquakes deeper than 200 kilometers. So we're covering the transition zone. We're not looking at that sort of upper 200 kilometers of the mantle here, I'm afraid. Now, part of the reason for that is that we know that the upper mantle is anisotropic basically everywhere. That's probably because olivine is quite strongly anisotropic and forms the texture fairly well. So we want to avoid sampling that region on the source side here. So this is the earthquake, and we measure it, this direct S wave at the seismometer. Now we can do quite a good job of correcting the upper mantle on the receiver side, so we can take away the green anisotropy over here. But if we were to look at earthquakes much shallower, it'd be much more difficult to remove that. So that's why we focus on 200 kilometers and below. So in this region, the earthquake occurs, and as it travels down into the lower mantle, it accrues some sort of shear wave splitting from the anisotropy that's present. Now, it's fairly good assumption, and indeed most of these global models agree, that the lower mantle doesn't host concerted strong anisotropy everywhere. So what we can do is assume essentially that the anisotropy we measure at the end, the splitting we measure, is due to the source region. And so that's what these measurements are. Okay, so we're looking at the region of the source. Now, as always with shear wave splitting, in theory, the splitting could occur anywhere along the path, and our job is to sort of try and work out where this is localized. So these are the earthquakes that we actually used in our study. And as you see, it's a sort of a few years ago that most of this was done. So there's 130 deep earthquakes in the end that produced usable measurements that were really, really high quality. One of the real keys in this type of study is that because you need to correct for this upper mantle on the receiver side, you need to be very, very sure of the splitting that occurs but underneath the stations. And because we're interested in transition zone anisotropy, we want to avoid stations where subduction zones are. Often people put a lot of stations on subduction zones because they're tectonically interesting. So we're sort of limited in exactly which stations we can use, and we end up with a coverage of the world that looks a bit like this. So the first thing I'm going to do is show you some sort of broad outline overall results that we got. And it's nice to have an hypothesis that you're going to investigate when you do these things. Now, what I'm going to show you is the amount of splitting for each earthquake station pair against the depth of the earthquake. Now, when I sort of started this, I thought, well, you know, my idea was that probably either we're looking at an effect of the lower mantle, or we're looking at an effect of the slab. And if it's the slab, it's probably olivine, say, in the slab that would give us the splitting that we observe. And so what we'd expect is something like this, where you know, have a sort of fairly constant amount of splitting, and then when you get in the transition zone, that just dies away with depth as the amount of olivine decreases. Equally, you could imagine something a bit different. You could even imagine that somehow texture sort of dies away, and then there isn't any splitting in the transition zone, which would be the old-fashioned view from a long time ago. What we actually see is this, which is no trend with depth. Okay, and this is robust. And what please ask me at the end. I've got all the regions separately. The different colours just are the different regions that we see. Now, this scatter actually reduces when you take into account the azimuth that the waves take. The elastic tensor is a four tensor, and so it's sort of quite complicated. And this is what often produces this perceived scatter. But what this tells you, number one, is that the transition zone, either within or around the slabs, is anisotropic. If you think a little bit harder as well, the fact that we have strong splitting right at the base of the transition zone, and the waves go downward away, tells you also that this effect, not all of the effect at least, and probably none of it, is actually due to the sort of ambient mantle around the earthquake in the transition zone over a large area, because we're not sensitive to that for these deeper events.
What are you plotting on the vertical axis?
This is the amount of splitting.
But what is S?
That's seconds.
Oh, that's just, okay, seconds.
So I'm a physicist, so I always write the units. So this is non-dimensional now, because it's depth divided by kilometres.
I know about physicists.
Yeah. But I know a lot of people like to put it in brackets, and I'm just like kind of weird like that, I know. Okay, so sorry about that. Yeah, so that's the amount of splitting in seconds. Okay, thank you for the question to clarify that. And I was saying that therefore probably the splitting is actually, it's either in the lower mantle or it's just around the event. So those are the two possibilities that are left now already just by looking at the data this way. So I'm going to not talk about that yet. So we've already sort of ruled out some of the options for causing splitting in the sort of transition zone more generally. And really, these are probably the reasonable candidates. So it could be metastable olivine, perhaps, or possibly it's just an effect of LPO, say, in bridgmanite at the top of the lower mantle. Well, the reason I sort of question mark this one, the bridgmanite explanation, is because you need a big region, actually, to produce the amount of splitting we observe that's quite strongly textured. This is, as you'll see, this is a problem with all the results anyway. But it's not a slam dunk necessarily that this is what's going on for these particular measurements. And I'm really looking forward to the next talk, actually, because as you'll see, I don't want to steal anyone's thunder, but there's an interesting comparison there. So some of the other, this list could go on and on in some ways. There are lots of other more interesting, in some ways, phases, such as these dense hydrous magnesium silicates, D, superhydrous B, A, the hydrous aluminum phases. Also, garnet in the akkermotoite, which is the ilmenite form, or it could equally be aligned inclusions of contrasting seismic properties that would give us this as well. So those are all things that we choose to investigate. So what we do is we take elastic constants for these different cases, so from the literature, from physical experiments, from ab initio calculations, and where we have them, we use the textures produced either in experiments or calculations, and we test how they fit our data. So some of the ones I'm going to show you now are sort of a general transverse isotropy, but also the experiments that have been done on akkermotoite in phase D, where they've been where there's uniaxial shortening, so sort of compression, giving you a sort of hexagonal symmetry. Also, I'm going to show you for sheared bridgmanite, and then again, this is from combination of experiments and calculations. So what we do is we take our target elastic tensor, and we know the path taken by the S wave away from the earthquake in that region, and we simply, for all different orientations, we rotate the crystal, and we produce synthetic splitting in that S wave, just like for the data, and we can compare that to the observed splitting, and we have a misfit, a sort of penalty function that we try to minimize. And this is a misfit designed for shear wave splitting, so feel free to ask if you want to know about that. And we do that for all the observations which each have a different azimuth and incidence angle away from this bit of the Earth that we're imagining. Now, something that emerged as we did this is that what's quite important and which changes the sort of coherence of the results is which reference frame you take when you do these calculations. Now, I apologise for the east arrow, which has had a bit of identity crisis and is pointing north. So one reference frame you could imagine would just be the geographic reference frame, but slabs aren't great respecters of north and east, and nor is Barbara's version of Keynote. So a much more sensible thing to do would be to have a reference frame where you take the slab strike into account, and the other direction would be sort of the dip direction, so it should actually point over here, and up. So we did this, but we actually found that our results are more self-consistent if you also take the slab dip into account. And so we have a reference frame where we have a slab strike, we have normal to the slab, and we have an up-dip direction. Okay, so now I'm just going to sort of explain properly what this means. So what we can do is plot all of our results in this slab frame. Now this is a slab, side view, and so the strike is into the page. And this is a lower hemisphere through that slab, and this is another view of that lower hemisphere. So this line down the middle is the intersection of that slab with that lower hemisphere. So down dip is in the middle of this plot, and it would plot in the centre of our lower hemisphere. So let's just take a few examples. So if we had something which is within the slab but pointing a bit along slab strike, that would be where this red dot is. It would plot over here, but you'd still have a ray leaving this zone that goes down the slab. Now, if we had something which sort of came out in the back arc direction a little bit and was perpendicular to the slab strike, it would plot where this red dot is and come out like here. And equally, any ray that leaves this region normal at 90 degrees to the slab is going to plot on the edge. And if it's going right in the back arc direction, it's going to plot on the left here. Okay. So it takes a little while to get your head around this sort of projection. But this is when you plot things in this frame, by far the most sort of coherency emerges between our results. So now let's actually look at our results. So this is the amount of splitting again. So darker colours indicate more splitting or sort of stronger shear wave anisotropy in that direction for all of our data. Now, the first thing you notice is that there's a lot of grey here. Now, just because of the Earth, the way it is and where the continents and subduction zones are, we have almost no sensitivity to the top, the mantle above the slab in the transition zone. So we just can't really say anything about that. But we do have much more sensitivity to stuff going out the back. And actually, sometimes, depending on the slab dip, we have rays that go straight out the back, and they plot on the edge here. Now, what you notice is that there's very strong splitting in this direction when you go straight out the back of the slab. And you then have a sort of a ring of small splitting and then another ring of high. Now, the sort of the anisotropists amongst you will recognise this as the pattern that's predicted by sort of layered inclusions or even sort of, you know, layered structures like micas or something like that. So this is a pattern we actually see, for example, in shale reservoirs and other situations where we have good coverage of the sphere in a similar way. But we're not just going to eyeball it, we're going to actually go through that procedure that I spent the time telling you about to invert the orientations of different candidate phases. So this is all the data globally. There's not a huge amount of data right now. There have been a lot of deep earthquakes recently, so what we will do is go back and update this at some point. I have a student working on that, and hopefully that can fill in some of these gaps, who knows. So if we do take a approach where we fit the data, we can plot up this penalty function, this misfit. And so what we're looking for is the regions of blue that fit our data best. And this colour, this lower hemisphere again in the same reference frame, is coloured by the rotational symmetry axis of this hexagonal symmetry here. So what that's saying is that if you have a medium which is hexagonally symmetric, the rotation axis, the symmetry axis, would be in this direction relative to the slab. That's what this sort of minimum point here is saying. So what we have is a sort of down dip, but slightly more vertical symmetry axis. And that's sort of totally consistent with layering or some sort of shortening that happens down dip, or perhaps slightly more vertical than that, which itself is entirely consistent with most p-axes for these events at the base of the transition zone. So our results are totally consistent with shortening, vertical shortening at the base of the transition zone. That's what, if it's occurring within the slab, that's what that orientation tells you. Now we can do the same for all of those different candidate phases I told you about. For instance, this is for phase D, and because we're using real textures, the symmetry in that is slightly lower, and we get sort of two different points, interestingly pointing two points along strike, both match our data sort of equally well. But again, it's the symmetry axis is going to be pointing in some direction down, mostly down dip, with a little bit off in the sort of shortening direction that we seem to see. So this is very interesting. So what we also did was investigated the sort of potential for there to be a thermal control on this. Now, if there's a thermal control, as you go down, you should see less splitting. But what we're doing is we're accounting for the fact that our rays go in different directions, and the shear wave splitting is going to vary with direction depending on the elastic tensor. So we can be a bit cleverer than that, than just looking at those splitting times, those delta t's. So just to sort of, you sort of summarise the data in terms of the slab thermal parameter here. So big numbers mean sort of colder core of the slab at a given depth. Again, the amount of splitting on this side, it doesn't really seem to vary systematically with this thermal parameter. Now that's just delta t. What we can do is make that sort of independent of the orientations of the shear waves that leave the region, and invert for the amount of olivine, say, that we would need. So this was done actually with some real textures from a prototype that Benismal and Mainprice produced the texture of. And this is the sort of the layer thickness you need of that thing to produce the splitting that we observe. And again, there's not really any clear depth-dependent variation in that. It doesn't seem like anything that should be thermally controlled is responsible. So this to me sort of feels like if it's metastable olivine which is causing our observations, that doesn't seem very likely. But who's to say that olivine has to preserve the texture that far down, or indeed has to actually be the cause of the anisotropy? So on its own, this doesn't rule anything in or out, but it does say that probably what we're seeing isn't metastable olivine causing the splitting itself. Okay, thank you. And so the explanation that we sort of favoured is that, you know, there's plenty of ways now of creating these exotic alphabet phases by having lots of water in your slab, and we could sort of calculate the amount of water that would be required to produce the splitting that we observed if it's some of these hydrous phases within the slab. This is along a slab geotherm. You can have a sort of a continuum of hydrous phases that typically are sort of hexagonal layered structures that are very anisotropic. And if you do say, how much water do you need, for instance, it's a lot. I mean, you can easily fit in, these are sort of weight percents, you can easily fit billions and tons of water per year down into the lower mantle if you require that to produce the splitting we observe. So that's, that's just one number. And really, we're still in the case of puzzling slightly over exactly what's causing this. So if I were to sort of summarise where we are with these observations, I think the key point really is that our orientations are sort of sub-parallel, as if you have layers, as if there's sort of vertical shortening, and that's what the results are consistent with. And there's some uncertainty about what's going on above the slab, and it could be that the upper mantle is being deformed, but you need a lot of it to be deformed over a long region, so that's why we sort of favour something to be in the region of the slab. So I'll finish there, and again, just leave up that plug for the meeting in May. Thank you very much.